Call the meeting to order. This is State Government Finance for Tuesday, May 3rd, 2011. And since we do have a quorum, you have the minutes before you for the April 28th and 29th meetings. Can we have a motion to approve those?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Murray moves the approval of the minutes from the 28th and 29th. Any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The first bill up today is House File 1360. Representative Torkelson, do you want to move forward?
I do.
And you may proceed. I will move House File 1360. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. It's my pleasure to be with you on this fine sunny morning. Those of us that farm for a living find it a little more difficult to come to work at the Capitol when the sun is shining, but but I'm here anyway, and trusting that the good help that I have back on the farm is in action today and getting the work done. We're a little behind a normal spring.
But we have a lot of anxious farmers up my way.
I know you do. They're all anxious.
So. They're anxious to get into the fields, and they're still way too wet.
We got started yesterday a little bit on my farm, and I expect they'll be rolling today on something. Anyway, to get to House File 1360, House File 1360 is a bill that was put together really to address the issue of the Environmental Quality Board. The Environmental Quality Board is an entity of Minnesota state government that was created back in 1973 and has done some very good work through the years. At one time, they had as many as, I believe, 27 or so employees. And had a very prominent role in state government. But over the years, that role has declined significantly. They currently are scheduled to have a staff of 4.5, and I believe that staff is really only about 2.5 right now because things have just been some of the issues, major issues they've dealt with in the past have either no longer been significant or have been actually taken away and put in other spots in state government. So my effort in this bill is to really dramatically downsize the EQB, get rid of some of the statutory requirements that they no longer deal with but are still in statute, save some money, and do my part to downsize state government, at least in a small way. This effort has been required a lot of gymnastics in the process, but we have a bill before you today that at least is one way of addressing this issue. The bill actually changes the EQB quite dramatically. It takes, right now the EQB is made up of, I believe it's 7 commissioners and 5 citizen members. My bill would remove the citizen members from the EQB. It would move the EQB from admin over to PCA, and instead of meeting quarterly, the EQB would meet at the call of the governor. There are some important duties that the EQB does deal with. They publish the EQB monitor. The EQB monitor is the state publication that informs people of the state of EISs and EAWs, environmental applications that are in process. It also deals with the petitions that are filed by citizen members if they're requesting that an EAW be put in place. That's important work that needs to be done, involves multiple state agencies, and somebody needs to do that. So that portion of the work continues, and the EQB board then would be made up only of commissioners and only meet when necessary. This does cut down on things dramatically. The bill also does repeal a number of issues that the EQB that they're really inactive issues that the EQB used to deal with, but they no longer deal with. So it does remove quite a bit of language in statute that is no longer necessary, and Mr. Chair, is pretty much a summation of the bill. I don't think we need to go into every detail of the bill this morning, but I'd be happy to stand for questions from the committee.
Members, the plan for this bill is to recommended passage and re-refer it back to environmental finance where the final work would need to be done. Questions for the author?
I should also add, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, that
Representative Torkelson.
There are a number of issues that the EQB deals with that deal directly with water, and those in proposed in this bill, those duties would be rolled into the duties of the Clean Water Council. Clean Water Council was created in 2006 when that act was passed, and they do meet monthly and deal directly with water issues, and it seemed appropriate that those particular duties be rolled into the responsibilities of the Clean Water Council.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Torkelson. According to the fiscal note, it shows that this is it will not be a savings but a cost to the state, even though I can understand we're downsizing or moving the responsibilities on to another agency, you would think would help, but I'm just kind of wondering why that is the way it is.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson for the question. It does save, when you look at the entire picture, it does save state government some money, but the cost is involved in the cost of actually operating the EQB under PCA. It's been under admin, and the annual cost has been estimated at $551,000. The cost when we get it over to a PCA, I believe, is $238,000. So the fiscal note is a little bit confusing because of the transfer from one agency to the other.
Thank you.
I would add that the governor's proposed budget also does similar action with PCA, moving it out of admin and over to, I'm sorry, with EQB, moving it out of admin over to PCA without any other changes, and the bottom line cost there was $151,000 compared to the $230,000 or 38 that my bill costs, and I know that Myrna Hallbeck is in the audience, and perhaps she could come forward and explain some of the fiscal note and gyrations involved with this bill, if you would like to hear more detail.
I'm okay.
Okay. Now, Representative Erdahl, did you wish to be recognized?
This is very good, don't it?
No.
Well, so noted. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson, thanks for. I was just. What I had intended to ask was how does this compare with what the governor does? I'm not on any of the environment committees, but I knew he was doing something, so thank you for that. Does the governor, though, also remove the public members? Or does he just shift them over to another?
Representative Torkelson.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I understand it, the governor's proposal just moves the current situation from admin over to PCA. And I know the director of EQB is here, Mr. Bob Patton. If you would, he could answer that question in more detail than I can.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could, I was wondering if there was anyone here from the administration or anyone to comment on it.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob Patton. I'm Executive Director at the Environmental Quality Board. To answer your question, no, the governor's proposal does not change the membership of the EQB. It merely moves the administration support function from the Department of Administration to the Pollution Control Agency. Also, the governor's proposal proposes a report to the legislature due next year on the role, responsibilities, and staffing of the EQB.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me ask a sensitive question. What would happen to you under this proposal? Would you...
Mr. Patton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I actually am an employee of the Department of Agriculture, and I am on loan to the Department of Administration and the EQB as executive director in a half-time position. This was due to budget cuts. The executive director funding was eliminated, and so this was a workaround solution.
Representative Simon.
Just one other comment. I wish Representative Kahn were here, I know in past years even, she's commented about the history of the EQB and why it was placed in the Department of Administration, because a lot of us who have only been around a few years were thinking at first, well, why is something like this in the Department of Administration? And she has the history, and she's resisted attempts by Democrats and Republicans in the past to move it from the Department of Administration, because she was present at the creation, apparently, and has some strong thoughts about why it was intentionally placed there and should remain there. She's not here, obviously, and I don't have the history, but could you just comment? Maybe it's just taking a position one way or another, but what is your understanding about why it was placed where it was?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative, I'll address the history a little bit and the rationale for the current move. The history is that in 2003, the staffing and support to the EQB was provided by the Office of Strategic and Long-Range Planning. And you'll notice in the statute it's still that way. That office was eliminated in 2003, and to provide continuing support, the EQB support and administration was moved to the Department of Administration. Actually, the offices were always in the Centennial Building, and it's remained there since. The current proposal to move support and administration to the Pollution Control Agency is not a policy change by any means. It's really simply to provide better efficiencies due to budget issues we're trying to deal with right now. It puts environmental staff in an agency with other environmental staff, so there can be some cross support to support the EQB functions.
Representative Simon.
Mr. Chair, just one final comment. I mean, I think there's a tension here between two worthy goals. One is cost savings and efficiency, a worthy goal. Representative Torkelson, another, which I understand to be Representative Kahn's argument in the past. Of course, I'm sort of channeling her here, but is that it was intentionally placed there for a reason, and the other worthy goal is, as strange as it may sound to an outsider, putting an environmental board in admin, that was intentional because they didn't want it to be part of PCA. That would be too close. They might lose their objectivity. It was intentionally placed outside so it could monitor in a more objective fashion. So I guess those are the two. There's a tension here, and they're both worthy goals.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Penn.
And the administration is quite aware of that tension, and the move to PCA is still intended to retain the integrity and independence of the staff. It's just to have it in an agency where it can be supported better.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Simon, for those questions. And I want to follow a little bit along that line. Was Representative Torkelson, was this bill heard in environment, or was it just held in environment and then they referred it to here?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the bill was heard in environment and passed on to this committee. The reason we're here today is because of the fiscal note and the fact that the budget has been in admin and would be moved to PCA, so it gets to be a bit of a gyration with the fiscal situation. And I think I would, if it suits the chair, like to hear from Ms. Hallbeck from PCA about the fiscal note and how it relates to the governor's proposal.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Patton.
Yes.
You're the executive person for the EQB.
Yes.
And how long have you served as the executive?
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Penn.
Representative Murphy, I've been in that capacity officially since October 2009, but actually unofficially since June 2009.
Okay.
Representative Murphy.
Okay. I think I'm going to wait and when the other testifiers are done, I may have a more complete picture before I speak.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Patton.
Thank you.
And Representative Torkelson, you wanted to call forward?
Yes, if that suits the chair, that's what I... the fiscal note was a bit of a surprise, Mr. Chair, and we've been trying to get a better understanding of that, and I think we can be enlightened a little bit this morning.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Myrna Hallback, and I'm the Assistant Chief Financial Officer for the Pollution Control Agency. And as Representative Torkelson said, we did a fiscal note that does show some expenses relative to this move, and those expenses are very close to what we anticipated when the governor proposed moving the EQB support to the agency. The difference in that and why this shows a fiscal note as compared to that is when proposed by the governor and put into his budget, the Department of Administration would have reduced their budget by $400,000. $151,000 of the general fund would have moved to the PCA for support of the staff, and we would have added $75,000 from the environmental fund. So when we did the fiscal note, we simply did it on what the cost, and as Representative Torkelson said, they're very similar in the total cost if you add the $151,000 and the $75,000, it's $226,000. So we're very close on those costs and intended, as we looked at the fiscal note, to very much mirror what we anticipated would happen with the transfer of the EQB to the Pollution Control Agency on the cost. So we were merely trying to show that effort and not where exactly the funding sources would go, because I couldn't assume general fund in this scenario that was coming to us, as our budget bills moving forward does not have general fund moving to the agency for EQB. So we really have tried to mirror the same costs that we did with the governor in the proposal.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallback, I see in the fiscal note that in doing the transferring, it looks like you're dividing it up between an environmental fund within the PCA and the Clean Water Fund within the PCA. Is that my understanding?
Ms. Hallback?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. And that mirrors what our, by statute right now, is the agency supports the Clean Water Council, and so as Representative Torkelson explained, some of those water duties moving from EQB to the Clean Water Council, we envisioned that, again, those kinds of technical support that EQB needed to carry out those functions would be needed for the Clean Water Council and then would be appropriate direct costs from the Clean Water Fund. That's our assumption. It may be explained to us differently, but that's kind of where we assumed it.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hallback, so the FTEs, it looks like two are going to the Clean Water Fund and one's going to the Environmental Fund. These volunteers that are mentioned, maybe Mr. Representative Torkelson can explain that. Do they get paid also through the EQB right now? And if not, is there an explanation for that?
Representative Torkelson?
I believe you're asking about the citizen members of the EQB board.
That's correct.
The expenses related to those members and to the quarterly meetings.
Yes, that's correct.
Ms. Hallback?
Mr. Chair, Representative, under the proposed, since they would no longer exist, we would not count those on the Clean Water Council. Anybody attending those meetings are funded as a per diem cost, but those costs already exist with the Clean Water Council meeting, so we didn't add a number of other meetings to that effort.
Okay, thank you.
Any further question? If not, thank you, Ms. Hallback. And Representative Torkelson, the motion would be to recommend to pass and re-refer this to Environment Finance. Is there any further discussion? Anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill? Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the benefit of the discussion that took place at the Environment Committee, and I just want to make a couple reflections.
Okay.
That over the years of the EQB, when it was this in my mind, and I was never on the Environment Committee, and so it's from my personal relationships with it and from reading the newspaper a lot and kind of remembering. But I've also been friends with some of the people that have been on the EQB board for all these years. And it seemed that to me that the EQB board was always made up of very dedicated people that wanted to do the right thing. And they went through extraordinary measures to make sure that the public was able to weigh in on the important decisions that they were making. And sometimes the EQB board's decisions were very controversial and uncomfortable. And their decisions, though, it seems to me, were always made with the intent of making a better Minnesota for future generations. And in the last decade, Representative Torkelson is right that their jobs have been switched around, and there's been so many fixits that maybe they have, and things taken out and other things added in, that maybe what we once knew as EQB, maybe the nucleus isn't even there now. I'm not sure of that. But I agree with what Representative Simon said, and what Representative Kahn would say if she was here, is that it seemed to me that was when it was in the Department of Administration, it wasn't the fox covering the chicken coop kind of thing so much. And I'm not sure that moving it into PCA, although I have the utmost confidence in what the PCA is trying to do. I'm a little more unfamiliar with the Clean Water Council, but I have no complaints with them either at this point in time. But it seems to me we should be very careful in dismantling this board even more before that report is out that Mr. Patton was speaking to. And part of that report, it seems to me, should be the history of the successes, successes and failures of the EQB, so that we could have a real measurement of it. I don't know if he's not, Representative Torkelson isn't recommending the elimination of it. It's just another Band-Aid when maybe we should have a full-fledged wrap. But I think we shouldn't just keep it in these limbos, and we should at one point in time, and this year isn't the year to do it, but I think we should either really cure it or say goodbye and thank you very much. But I would hope that what would emerge out of the whole thing would be a stronger, reflective board that truly went back to the mission of making a better Minnesota and environment of and recommendations, and maybe even keeping the controversy so that the people had some place to turn when there are very difficult environmental problems. Thank you.
And Representative Murphy, that judgment now will be in the hands of the Environment Finance Committee if this were to move forward. Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Murphy, for those remarks. I actually share many of your concerns, and thank you, Representative Simon, for channeling Representative Kahn's concerns. You know, that certainly is a concern, that moving the EQB to the PCA is an issue, because the EQB does deal with overarching issues that involve multiple state agencies. And so this is not meant to be necessarily the end of the line, but a step in the right direction that actually recognizes that the EQB has changed dramatically over the years. I did interview two of the citizen members of the EQB in the process of preparing this bill and took input from them, along with Mr. Patton, and I'm sure they wouldn't agree with every detail of the bill. I'm not saying that, but this was considered carefully, and I've tried to recognize the changes that have occurred over time. At the same time, look forward to the needs that are there in addressing these overarching issues, and whether this bill becomes part of the environment omnibus bill or not, I believe that the issue has been raised to the surface, and one way or another will receive some attention and some careful attention and work over the next few months, so that hopefully in the end we address these important concerns and at the same time do what we can to downsize and reduce the cost of state government.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Torkelson, whether it becomes part of the omnibus bill, is that the intent, to have it in the omnibus bill and not travel separately?
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That remains to be determined by the Environment Committee.
What is your hope?
My hope. I hope my bill has a good future.
Seeing no further discussion, I will renew the motion that House File 1360 be recommended to pass and be re-referred.
Mr. Chair, I think Representative Simon is going to request a roll call, but I'll jump in and do it for him.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'll renew the motion that the House File 1360 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Environment Finance. Roll call having been requested, call the roll.
Anderson?
Yes.
Banyan?
Yes.
Benson?
Yes.
Downey?
Yes.
Gauthier?
No.
Green?
No.
Gunther? Hayden? Kahn? Lanning?
Yes.
Leidiger?
Yes.
Lilly?
No.
Lohmer?
Yes.
McElfetrick?
Yes.
Murphy?
No.
Murray?
Yes.
Simon?
No.
Slawik?
No.
Stansrud?
Yes.
Erdahl? Winkler?
No.
There being 10 ayes and 7 nays, the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Since Representative Kiefer is here, we will move her bill next. Representative Kiefer. Welcome, Representative Kiefer.
You can have a seat right here if you want.
Hi.
And I will move House File 1362 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Ways and Means. Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1362 is a great Peace in the Valley bill. It is coming from a recommendation of the Work Comp Advisory Board, which consists of leadership from the Commissioner of Department of Labor and Industry, Mr. Ken Peterson, and also the head of the AFL-CIO, Cher Knutson, and the president of Chamber of Commerce, Mr. David Olson. The bill has been worked on for quite a few months, and this is the agreement that the council has come up with. The bill addresses the use and timing of settlement conferences for an injured worker before hearing. It also addresses the need for flexibility in scheduling to avoid unnecessary resets, which cause a delay in their treatment. It also addresses the need and use for experienced and independent decision makers at the hearings. It includes provisions requiring a change for formula and calculated medical fees and prescription drugs. It has a few technical changes, and Mr. Chair, I have a couple of amendments that I would like to move.
Let's take your amendments now. Which amendment would you like to do first?
I'll do the A3 amendment.
Okay, I will move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape that the author prefers. All in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. A3 is adopted.
Okay, and did anyone have any questions about this amendment? I had a little physical note on it, but okay.
Okay.
Pretty self-explanatory. And then the next amendment is A4. And I don't have a copy of that one. Thank you. This just deals with, again, some technicalities. It's got agreement from both the Chamber of Commerce and the AFL-CIO. It has to do with if there's remodeling after an injury and somebody needs a ramp built in their home or some remodeling. And it addresses some costs that can be actually saved if there's no need for an architect.
I will move the A4 amendment. Any question? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed. Motion carried. The A4 amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Now you may proceed to cover the bill as amended and as you preferred.
I kind of gave the background of it already. I have the assistant commissioner with me. Gary Hall, and he'd be happy to answer questions too, maybe about the background of why this bill came through. Otherwise, I might be able to answer some questions as well.
Mr. Chairman, please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Gary Hall. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Safety and Workers' Compensation at the Department of Labor and Industry.
Do you want to speak to the bill?
We've got about three different parts to this bill. The first part makes a number of changes that speed up the dispute resolution process at the Office of Administrative Hearings. It sets specific timelines for the holding of a settlement conference and the holding of a hearing. When we checked our statistics in the department, we found that it was taking about 212 days from the filing of a claim until there was a settlement conference held. This bill requires that it be done within 180 days, which should speed up the litigation process by about a month. Additionally, the bill requires that the hearings be held by people who are qualified to do workers' compensation hearings. There were some instances where contract judges were held or were holding conference or hearings, and what the bar found was that it took more time to educate the contract judges because the work comp law is very complicated. A number of attorneys compare it to tax law in terms of complications. The bill makes a few changes which codify previous changes that were made in 1998 that were never codified before. It was necessary to do that while we were amending these statutes. But if you notice that there are changes in there that look like they're unrelated. They're housekeeping changes. They don't change the law. They just codify what was previously changed. In addition to the dispute resolution provisions, there is a section, I think it's the A4 amendment, mm-hmm. that permits remodeling without an architect's certification in cases where it's been approved by the housing official and the disability council, what we found was that even minor changes required an architect's involvement and the expense of an architect's involvement. This allows some of the remodeling to be done without that. The bill also raises the limit that an injured employee can spend on remodeling, something that hadn't been increased since the mid-90s. We at the department also asked for a provision in here which allows for a change in the formula for calculating the fee limits on pharmaceutical drugs. Now, the reason for the change is a lawsuit which found that the base we were using was inappropriate. And we're changing to a different base, but it doesn't change the fee, the maximum fee. So all we're doing is changing the method of calculation, not the outcome of the calculation. I think. Well, it matched. Yeah, the change we're making is the same change that the Department of Human Services will be making in their bill. There is no other standard other than the one that we've chosen. Any questions?
Representative Murphy. I'm sorry, Representative Murphy. Representative Benson was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hall, this one-time transfer of $600,000, that fund must be pretty flush with money, huh?
Our fund,
Mr. Hall.
Mr. Chairman, members, the fund is put together with an assessment that's assessed every year. So we recalculate the charges to the insurers and self-insurers every year. It isn't a fund of money sitting there. Each year we appropriate just the money for that particular year. This provision for the $600,000 will be part of the assessment for the next year. My understanding is it won't raise the assessment because we have a diminishing liability in the second injury and supplementary benefit funds, which were repealed back in the 90s. There's a diminishing number of cases, and each year the amount goes down. So even though there may be as much as a 0.18 increase in actual cost, the assessment won't be raised.
Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So from what I just heard from your testimony, there won't be an increase in the request from the folks that have to pay this.
That's
Mr.
my
Hall.
Understanding.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Benson.
Mr. Hall, and maybe you won't know this. I heard a number one time that astounded me, and it maybe is an aside to this, but I'd certainly, since I have you in front of me, would like to ask you, what percent of the dollars that are paid in by employers to workman's comp actually go to people who are injured?
Mr. Hall.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm not sure. I can check on that and get back to you.
Mr. Chairman. I would like to get something from the department regarding of the dollars that are paid in, how much actually go to people who are injured. Thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative and Mr. Hall, when the council was talking about the new changes so that remodeling can get done, was there discussions with just the AFL-CIO representatives on the council, or did you get input from the building trades too?
Mr. Hall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, both the business and labor side of the council were in attendance when this provision was discussed. Both sides have given approval, and we've actually run the language past the Council on Disability as well as our internal construction codes and licensing people. We have an architect on staff. So it was approved by both business and labor.
Representative Murphy?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Clark, I understand that it was approved, but I'm questioning whether there was discussion or was there anybody in, anyone give testimony in opposition?
Mr. Hall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, there was no testimony at the meeting. The provision was presented by the department.
Representative Murphy, I think we have a couple of people here who can address your question. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of Labor and Industry, and I had the wrong time, so I apologize to the members for being late. Representative Murphy, in terms of your question, just to add to what Assistant Commissioner Hall said, the building trades, there are several representatives of the building trades on that committee. They approved, they agreed with the remodeling idea, with that concept. And we had a lot, it was, a certain, there was I suppose about 20, 25 minutes worth of discussion, but it was there was not any outside testimony per se. There was just discussion. It was brought to them by the department, and the members then discussed it.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, have you received any opposition since that time?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Murphy, no.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, who decides if you don't need an architect?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Hall?
Representative
Gauthier.
The bill provides for three levels of review, basically. The first level of review is by the contractor and the homeowner. They have the right to request that an architect participate. Second level is with the building official who's approving the plans for the remodeling. The bill specifically requires the building official to look at the issues regarding access and accessibility. The third level, of course, is the Council on Disability, which finally approves it.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talk about a building official, are you talking about like a local building inspector or like a city building inspector?
Mr. Hall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gauthier. Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? If not, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to be heard relative to this bill? Seeing that no one else wishes to be heard, Representative Kiefer, further comment or?
I would just ask members to pass this. It's a good bill. It's going to help injured workers get the care they need quicker and more efficiently and probably save some money in the long run.
Okay, members, I will renew my motion that House File 1362 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor signify by I'm sorry, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, was this bill amended with their amendments?
Yeah, I'm sorry, as amended.
Thank you.
I would move that House File 1362 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to Ways and Means. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you,
thank
Representative
Kiefer.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair members.
You know it. It's the first conversation.
Representative Downey. Representative Downey, you want to move your bill?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 545, and Mr. Chair, I think the best motion would be to lay it over here in this committee. We're waiting on a fiscal note. This is a fiscal committee, and I think we'd be remiss to pass it through without that.
Yes, members, because we're still awaiting a fiscal note, we will lay this bill over, but we will hear it today and discuss it today and and wait till we get the fiscal note to take final action. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The genesis for this bill is the fact that the federal government essentially is broke. We have a terrible fiscal situation over in Washington. It doesn't appear that there's a real serious interest in addressing that and fixing it, and I think we would be wise here at the state to begin doing a little bit of planning in a more formal way about the possibility and what it would mean if the federal government actually were not able to come through on all of its funding commitments. One person's opinion, but I think there's probably no choice but for the federal government to start cost shifting to the states, entirely possible, maybe unavoidable, irrespective of many of our opinions about the necessity of increasing taxes or not, that the federal government would have to also increase taxes. I think it's highly possible, depending on one or two dominoes falling in the wrong direction for the feds, that we might have cash flow problems and potential default problems there. It's also my observation that our administration is kind of doubling down on the dependency on the federal government, at least in the healthcare arena and the education arena. So I think this is a good idea, a reasonable and prudent idea. Any large organization typically will have some kind of a risk management plan, evaluate circumstances such as losing your biggest customer, losing your biggest supplier, having a critical supply chain all of a sudden go down, and develop a bit of a contingency plan around those scenarios and say, what would we do if this this potential risk, this potential event actually did occur. So the bill says that every 2 years during the biennial budgeting process, the state agencies that receive federal funds must include as part of their budget proposal to the legislature a high-level risk analysis of what federal funding streams there are in that agency, what would be the impact of losing those federal funding streams to any material degree. What would the agency do? What would the recommended strategy be if we did lose those funding streams? And then some kind of a plan to monitor the leading indicators that would say, gee, we are at risk in these federal funding streams, and begin to have a plan for what you would actually do on the ground if you started to see the loss of federal funding. Remember, some of this is triggered by the fact that Standard & Poor's downgraded the outlook for federal debt to negative. That hasn't yet translated into interest rates increasing, or hasn't translated into any impact at the Treasury or the Federal Reserve or the federal government, but it's entirely possible. I actually offered this bill a year ago as well, thinking that this would be just a good, prudent discipline, much like any other business would do, recognizing that 30% of our overall all-funds revenue comes from the federal government. I think with the S&P announcement of a week or so ago, it's got increased urgency in my mind, and I think this is just a good, prudent planning step that the agency should participate in.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, what do you anticipate?
I'm sorry, Representative Anderson. Representative Slawick was next. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, it's always interesting to see the pieces of legislation you're coming forward with. I mean, they're often, sometimes I feel like I'm reading the one-minute manager, and now I feel like I'm listening to talk radio a little bit. I've heard this debate on the radio about whether the federal government is going broke or not, and read about it in the papers, and read all the same stuff you probably do. Is this tied? I mean, do you see this being tied to the debt ceiling and the vote that they're going to be taking on that? And if they don't pass that, I mean, that's one of the more significant things that I see might trigger something like this. Did that go into your thinking about this bill?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slawick, actually it didn't. Again, I authored this bill, I don't know, 18 months ago or whenever I first introduced it. So I think this is just a good business practice when literally 30% of our all funds revenue comes from one source, that some assessment of the risk of that going away makes sense. It was actually my push to actually really have the bill heard and move forward. Was more driven by the S&P outlook negative declaration, which starts to tell you that the markets are getting nervous And while, again, that hasn't translated into an interest rate increase on our debt, I feel like we're only one or two untoward events away from that occurring. And if people want to watch our deficit escalate, just dial up the interest rate on our treasuries and our debt instruments at the federal level.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Sloan,
follow up. But isn't the real issue that in, of course, the state of Minnesota, we have to balance our budget. We have a constitutional obligation to do that, and so a lot of what we struggle with is how to balance it. But at the federal level, do they have to balance the budget?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, no, they don't.
Mr. Chairman, that's what I would say in the arguments that I hear about this, and this is a national argument right now, is that we don't have to balance the national budget, the federal budget, so therefore to do contingency planning on a budget that theoretically can't go out of balance seems a little bit far-fetched to me. I'd be interested to see what the fiscal note comes in to be in terms of how we would do this.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downing, do you know how OPEC sets oil prices in what currency?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gauthier, no.
It's in U.S. dollars. That's how it's traded. And I don't see OPEC rushing to bail on that, but my one question really is, has the United States government ever defaulted?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, not that I'm aware of. Representative Gauthier, no. Okay,
thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was, because we don't have a fiscal note yet, I'm just wondering or anticipating what your thoughts are on what you think that the costs might be in relationship to having our government do an analysis like this, your assumptions. I guess that's what we always get is assumptions, so I'm looking for your assumption.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Anderson, good question. There would be an upfront effort required to identify where these federal funding streams are, to do the initial risk assessment and some contingency planning. And then after that, the level of effort goes down dramatically because you're simply updating and maintaining those on an ongoing basis. I don't know what the administration will come back with in terms of a fiscal note. Actually, my a thought would be that as Representative Banyan's zero-based budgeting bill advances, that requires a couple of different scenarios to be presented with each of the budget proposal documents that come to the legislature from the executive branch agencies, that perhaps this would just be a subcomponent of one of those scenarios. So I know we'll get a fiscal note from the departments, and we'll have a sense for what they see it being in a standalone, you know, kind of startup, just get it going. And then we can figure out whether or not and at what cost to try and weave it into perhaps a zero-based budgeting approach.
Representative Banyan.
I was going to look something up there, but let me go ahead and ask these questions anyway. First of all, let me point out that while we have never, formally defaulted on our debt in the United States, so the point that Representative Gauthier was making is correct, that you can get repudiation by other means. You can get repudiation of debt partially through inflation. Inflation would be a way of simply having the government print money in return for that, extinguishing debt with it, but what you're getting are simply pieces of non-interest-bearing debt in return for pieces of interest-bearing debt. That is something that's done in many countries. And so one of the real concerns we should have is, even though we continue to sell all of commodities in the reserve currency, which is still the dollar, and the dollar is still a very large currency that can't easily be replaced by any other currency on the planet, at some point there has to be concern about where we're going. We are facing right now the highest debt levels in peacetime. Okay, to go back and find a point where we had...
We're not as decent.
Okay, well, we don't have a formal declaration of war with anybody. So these are the highest. These are the highest debt levels we have had. And right now, what the problem is that right now we need to be concerned about whether or not people recognize this country as engaging in a Ponzi scheme by using future debt to pay off current debt. This is the insolvency that I think Representative Downey is talking about, and it's important. And I think one of the triggers and the question I have in this for Representative Downey is whether or not within this insolvency planning there would be some consideration of the effects of higher inflation induced by the attempt to monetize the debt. What would that be on our costs and on our revenues coming into our budget? Because that would be a source of real concern for us, I believe.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Interesting question. Actually, the strict language of the bill, and my intention here is not to try and play economists here. We have an economist, and I'm guessing that all of their forecasts are at least in some measure related to and driven by projections of interest rates and those kinds of things. This is really just a very practical bill that says if you're a state agency or you're running a program and 50% of your funding comes through the federal government and you have people dependent on that program or expectations of service levels, and there is a reasonable or perhaps possibility of the federal government cost shifting to the states or not meeting its obligations eventually, this is just about prudent planning. And so I think this is less about trying to forecast the national scene, but clearly the national scene is the backdrop, which prompts me to push this bill even stronger today.
Representative Banyard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Downey, then let me go further. What kind of indicators would be looked for in the bill? I'll give you an example. What would you be considering looking at the rate on credit default swaps related to U.S. Treasuries?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Banyard, that's a good question. Again, that might be one of the triggers or the factors that we try to monitor. I don't want to try and prescribe that here. I'm not an economist. I think we would rely on the expertise within the executive branch and within the academic community around here to say what are the leading indicators. Just as a normal person watching what's happening and realizing that we have a $1.6 billion annual deficit, I don't even know what the number is now, 14, 18 trillion, or I'm sorry, $1.6 trillion deficit, 14, 18 trillion in accumulated debt, whatever, I hear different numbers, 60 to 100 trillion in unfunded liabilities along with that, and just some really basic statistics. You add up the corporate profits of the top 1,000 companies in the United States. Top 1,000 companies in the United States, those corporate profits total $409 billion. That's one-fourth of our annual deficit. And so if we think that we're somehow going to grow our way out of this, anyway, I just think you look at just normal person indicators of what's happening on the national political and economic scene, and you realize that what we're doing in Washington is unsustainable, untenable, and you also, at least I don't see any real serious action on the part of the administration to come to grips with it. So I just think we would be prudent here at the state to do some planning and assess whether or not we could continue to provide the levels of service here that we've committed to without those funding streams in their entirety.
Well,
Representative Banyard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Downey, I thank you for bringing this. This is an important issue. There's a lot of research going on in economics right now about where is this level where we get into real trouble. I'll even take this moment to recommend a book on this called This Time It's Different by Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff on this very question. And the magic number in their book, looking over centuries of economic history. The magic number is around 90% of GDP, and if you take the last projection by the Office of Management and Budget in the Obama administration at in 2020, their numbers approach, they just come under 90%. So there is a point where we have to be concerned, because if we reach that level, what Reinhart and Rogoff show is that the growth of GDP slows down. That means the growth of revenues for the state budget slow down as well, and that's a very serious concern for us going forward. So I do think us paying attention to federal debt and the potential for insolvency are issues of great importance to this body, and thank you for bringing them up.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Downey, you in your comments, you talked about the federal government starting to not meet its obligations, and it sounded as though you meant because of budget pressures in Washington, funding for things like education and health care, human services type programs might decline. But your bill says insolvency, and I wonder if you could clarify if you're actually worried about the United States of America becoming insolvent, or if you're talking about budget pressures slowing, or budget pressures causing payments to states to slow over time or to reduce, to gradually shrink.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winkler, both.
Well,
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chairman, I guess so much for national unity. Representative Downey, your bill reminds me of the comments of Senator McConnell soon after President Obama was elected, which is that his number one goal and the number one goal of the Republican Party was to see him fail. And I think you know that this bill doesn't address a situation that's anywhere close to reality. It's fantasy. I'm afraid it might be a partisan fantasy to see failure on this colossal of a scale. Frankly, if the federal government becomes insolvent, I'm not so concerned about the effect on state programs. I'm concerned about the looters who are going to be running through our neighborhoods. I mean, you're talking about almost an Armageddon kind of situation in the country where the United States basically falls apart. I don't think we didn't default during the Civil War. We didn't default during the Great Depression. World War II came on the top of that, which caused by far the largest run-up of debt. We didn't default then. We're certainly in no position to be worried about it, any kind of a serious situation like those events. And there are multiple reasons why we have deficits and debt running at this level. Both of them are because of current events, the fiscal and financial and economic cliff that we almost went over. And thanks to the fast action of President Bush and President Obama, that didn't happen, and the Congress. We have two wars held over from the last administration. We have massive tax cuts that were passed in the last administration. And I'm assuming you're not going to stand here, and I'm assuming Representative Bannon won't either, try to haul out the Laffer curve to say that if you cut taxes, you're going to bring in more revenue. So the tax cuts were part of that. And we can all disagree on elements of the stimulus bill that caused part of this debt and deficit issue, but I don't think any economists out there of any seriousness question the fact that that actually stopped a major economic depression from setting in. So it's important to not use the historic events that we have been dealing with on a national basis as a means for causing people to lack trust in the ability of our political system to right the ship. There's no indication that that's different now than it ever has been before. And there's always, we're in a legislative body. We know what happens just before you take a tough vote. Everybody stamps their feet and beats their chest and protests that it's not going to happen and they're going to stand strong. And then when you're staring at a deadline that is going to cause real problems, you suddenly knuckle under. That's what happens. And there's no reason to expect that this won't happen. I just think it's on the contrary to it being prudent, I think it's irresponsible to raise this issue of federal insolvency. I think it feeds a myth about the federal government and a myth about the strength and the vitality of the United States, both economically and politically. And I think you should put it away. Now, in the last committee, I have the original handwritten draft of the amendment that I offered. I won't offer it today, but I think your bill should also consider things like asteroid collisions, nuclear war, extraterrestrial invasion, coup d'etat, and one for you, you know, natural disasters caused by global warming. That's, to me, what your bill, the kinds of scenarios that your bill is anticipating that we should plan for. It's irresponsible, Representative Downey, to raise this.
Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Winkler, those are a lot of the things that I was, the book of Eli, the movie is what I started to think about in terms of if this actually happens and what state our state would be in if this happened. I think we'd have a lot more to worry about than simply having state agencies look at their contingency plan. But I do have a really more practical question, and I'm really amazed at the amount of smart people we have in the room. But my question would be, Representative Downey, do you think that the state offices, the executive branch offices, have the capacity to do this work if this bill was enacted?
Representative Downey.
Or the resources?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, we talked a little bit about that before. Representative Anderson asked a question about the fiscal note and how they would do this. It's my anticipation that when the fiscal note comes in, that we'd see some kind of an upfront initial activity over the next 2 years. The bill says that with the budget proposal documents that are submitted, that the agencies would include some contingency identification of the federal funding streams and contingency planning around their potential loss. So there would be an initial effort to do the risk assessment, develop some high-level contingency plans in the monitoring process, and then after that you're in maintenance mode, and it's a much smaller ongoing effort. So my sense is we'd see a bit of a spike in terms of costs, and then it would flatline after that at a much lower level. I haven't seen the fiscal note to know. We also talked a little bit about the possibility of weaving this into the zero-based budgeting bill, which has requires three different scenarios in every major program area be submitted to the legislature. And one thought that I had was that we would try and amend some kind of component of this language into that zero-based budgeting proposal so that the contingency planning would be part of one of those scenarios.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hayden.
Good. Thank you, Representative Downey. What I was trying to figure out is I know that a couple of years before I started in the legislature last term, Governor Pawlenty got rid of the state's planning department. And though I don't know all the things that the state planning department did, I just remember coming from local government that the planning department's there, though they may do different things in terms of growth and outlooks of cities, that was an important notion that people really thought, because it had gone away, that we didn't have the ability to really look forward to plan for our state. So, Representative Downey, do you think that it would be appropriate to maybe think about a new state planning department, or better yet, in the case that our current, I guess where I'm trying to go is, should we hire more people at the state level to do this work, or is there maybe an opportunity for a firm or for us to outsource to do this work? I'm just trying to kind of think that through when we talk about resources. What does that really mean? Does that mean, you know, kind of a consultant relationship with someone that would help us, or should we kind of institute a new planning agency or something of the sort? I'm just trying to get a sense of what this would look like.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hayden, my own sense is that we don't need a separate standalone agency just to perform this. I'd say most large organizations, risk management and contingency planning is always something that's tough to invest in. And when you're a small to medium-sized business or organization, you typically blow it off, and that's why you see so much turnover in those size companies and organizations, is because they haven't really figured out formal ways to mitigate their risks and manage their risks, and so they're always a little more vulnerable. For an organization the size of the state of Minnesota, I absolutely think we should do planning. And, you know, we do in some places, right? Homeland Security, we have all kinds of disaster plans for many of the natural disaster scenarios and other terrorist and other public safety related incidents that Representative Winkler was referring to. So on many fronts, we already have done a lot of this in state government in conjunction with local governments. So I think it's probably something that can exist within the existing planning structures and mechanisms that we have. Again, would it require a little burst of energy and activity, maybe some outside resources? I didn't prescribe that in here, but I look forward to seeing the fiscal note from the agencies to see their sense of how big an activity this would be up front, and then we can plan from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. you mentioned the federal government's inability to meet its obligations in the bill here, and I know that before I ran for office that, because I have a daughter that is disabled and physically handicapped, that my school system and other school systems that we'd been acquainted with dealing with her situation, her health situation, that they were always complaining that the money that was coming from the federal government, they had mandated 40% of money that's supposed to come down, but every superintendent or person in the school district would say, we're getting a piddly amount based on, and the state's having to make up the difference. What other areas of federal government, if you can share with me, and maybe you don't know, but a situation like that where the federal government has mandated that we have this amount of money coming down and then they don't even meet the obligation that they're bringing down, we have to make up the difference for it. And I'm just wondering if there's other areas.
Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. That's a great question, and I wish I had an exhaustive answer for you. I really don't, and that's one of the purposes behind this bill, is that I don't think even in the legislature, oftentimes in the very fiscal committees that we sit on, do we have a really clear picture of what the federal funding streams are and where the matches are and what the dependencies are and what the requirements are and what's unfunded, et cetera. And this would provide, I believe, a real education to the legislature and even more so to the public, who I don't think has a clue that 30% of our all funds budget is actually coming from the federal government. So that's maybe an overriding comment, but your example of special education is perfect. I mean, there's a federal mandate. They don't fund it all. We try and supplement that here at the state. We can't come close to doing it, and the burden falls to the local schools to try and fulfill that mandate. And I mentioned the comment that I think we're doubling down a little bit. The federal health care reform is very attractive to states right now because there's such a healthy match from the feds. You know, disability programs, I think, are basically a one-to-one match here in state government, maybe total of $3 billion, $1.5 from the state, $1.5 from federal. We're in situations with the federal health care reform where I think it's about a four-to-one match right now. And the thought that with these kind of deficits, a $1.6 trillion annual deficit, that the federal government is going to be able to sustain that level of match and not cost shift, that's a question I ask just as an outside observer. And so I think the real value of this proposal is that we'd start to think about it, we'd start to educate ourselves, and we'd start to educate the public on what these dependencies are and interrelationships, and that in itself would be extremely valuable.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one of the things that I object to this bill about, and this has also been pointed out by several other members, is the fact that the last thing we need to do is to increase the time that people spend worrying about things that may not happen. I actually have a bill in, which you're welcome to join on as a co-author, as you if you would like, which deals with this problem on the state level, which is, if you don't hang out with people who actually work in state government, if you kind of sit up here in an ivory tower and just think that you're bossing them around and making plans for them to carry out, you don't know what happens as the state faces shutdown. And one of the things that happens is that the state kind of shuts down prematurely, in the fact that everyone starts thinking about how they get defined as essential employees. I don't know if we ever got a cost as to what all the activity that we went to the one time that we did shut down temporarily about the setting up a panel of judges to decide what was an essential what was an essential employee or what. People start, their primary concern then becomes, what about this vacation that they've arranged to take in September, that it's now clearly more prudent to move into July when the government is shutting down. And the lack of effective work that gets done is enormous, and I think this bill feeds into that paranoia, or even not, maybe not paranoia, you know, realistic worrying. The bill that I put in actually follows the model that Wisconsin and I think other states does, and in a sense the federal government does too, which is goes with the continuing resolution, which continues essential features and continues actually all parts of state government at a somewhat lower level, so that whatever is happening, and we know we always want to change things in the state budget, so it's kind of this feeling, it's the feeling of giving people a sense of continuity is much better than making them tense up to fight a deadline. There is this sense that people, you know, I don't want to get gender specific about what gender likes this idea of coming up against a conflict and which one would rather negotiate a smooth landing. But, you know, I think that's something, the kind of thing that we ought to be doing instead of doing a bill that gets people worried about things that may not happen and puts a lot of unproductive activity into doing it. I noticed one thing that's missing in the kinds of things that we're not looking at. I'm sorry I missed the EQB crisis, the EQB bill. I had a home crisis that I had to attend to. But the I told Ryan when it was a loose chicken there. But the you know, I know one of the things I noticed that EQB kept, which since I was responsible for the instigation of it, I was kind of interesting to see that it was kept, was you kept the their review of genetically engineered organisms, which is one of the things that we sort of relied on the federal government to do and that they've done improperly. So why don't we deal with that, that we might have an attack of genetically engineered organisms in this bill?
So. And Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, I think that might have been a question.
Yes, the question is, why are we increasing the level of paranoia instead of doing something to decrease it, since a level of increased paranoia means that state government, which we're asking to work more effectively, will work less effectively by experience of what's happened in the past.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair and Representative Cotton, I think we're already doing that. The CDC and the Department of Health, and I don't even know if Homeland Security gets woven into that, but I do know there are pandemic plans, and that's a pretty robust disaster recovery contingency plan that already exists in the state and federal government. So I think we're arguing for just some level of similar preparedness, maybe not to the detail that they have in their execution plans over there, but at least to identify and at a high level document what we would do here within kind of the program areas that are funded by the federal government. So I think what you're talking about already exists.
Representative Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Downey and I have some concerns. Words are really important. And I'm just going to preface my comments before we get to some of the words that were used. And they're really important to me because I'm a therapist, and so I have to look at those kind of things. But, you know, we have a $1.6 trillion deficit because we're fighting two wars. And they're the Bush-Obama wars. And maybe after we've killed Osama bin Laden, maybe it's time to come home and that would reduce our deficit. And maybe we should join together in that scenario. But it is amazing to me, you know, I guess I came to state government a little naive. I mean, we talk about federal mandates and then we complain about them, but yet we take the money. If we don't want the mandate, don't take the money. And then we talk about what your bill seems to be saying is we need to find these dependencies that we have. Is that correct? Is that what your bill is trying to figure out in the assessment, is this dependency we have with the federal government?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gauthier. Yeah, that's, I think, a fair way to put it, to locate where we have the federal funding streams and to identify what the impact would be if we were to lose them in some material way.
Okay. Well, and what concerns me of that is there's a big difference between being dependent and interdependent. And our founding fathers established a system of interdependency, and it's called the Union. And what concerns me about this, because if we have to look into the future, and I think your motives are legitimate and your concerns are legitimate, but what this does is begin to set the stage of separation from that union. And we sat on the floor and talked about the 10th Amendment on Godly, forgetting of the hundreds of thousands of men and women that died in the Civil War. And now we're back to that. And that disturbs me. And we use this fear. All of a sudden we have this fear of this tremendous deficit. A deficit that was expounded upon. You can't even compare what the deficit built with Obama compared to George W. Bush in his two wars. You know? And I'm not excusing President Obama. I think it's time to come home. But this is henny penny and the sky is falling. And maybe Henny Penny belongs to Representative Kahn's chicken coop. I don't know, but and the boogeyman. And we can't be operating government on fear. We have to be operating and it disturbs me that we talk about government as an organization. Government is government. And we're a part of this union. And if the United States of America becomes insolvent, we're not going to have a means to protect ourselves financially. We will be insolvent. And it's time to start thinking about, my God, we're all Americans. And we're trying to figure out a way to get under, away from, if the government collapses? My God, that's something wrong with that.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wow. I want to thank you for the bill and what it brings to the table in terms of contingency planning. And I'll get a couple of questions. I have a few comments, of course. And first is, I can't remember a time in business as a manager that we didn't have a contingency plan. And a lot of those, of course, were pre-planning done before we got a budget. So the what ifs. And I know that some of this will be done in zero-based budgeting because there'll be proposals that will be brought forward from the agencies will then, if this, then this, at various stages of funding levels. Quick comments, I guess. You know, I know that the economies of Greece and Portugal and Spain and England are all a whole lot smaller than the United States, but, you know, I'm thinking to myself, that, you know, is there a correlation between the lack of planning and I won't go there. I guess I get two questions about the bill. I think potentially there could be some more language added in terms of federal insolvency contingency planning, adding to the insolvency piece. I don't, you know, say take it out, but maybe adding more because we could see some significant reduction. Maybe the will at the federal level to really get their arms around bending the curve on federal spending, which would mean that we would see some reduced funding at the state level. So could you incorporate potentially there? And as I think about the fiscal note that's coming out, and in terms of trying to maybe mitigate the impact at that, could we look at a future date? You know, that as a transition of additional work, that if not this budget request period, the next budget, so that they begin to work on strategies and how they would come about, so that we don't have a large fiscal note because they say they have to add a lot of people to the process in order to get it done. This seems to me like a normal part of the budgeting process in most businesses. You never know how much the availability of funds. You know, you hope and pray the economy stays good, interest rates stay low. But any business that's doing well has contingency planning on what they're going to do with funding stream. So those two questions, potential for more language to add in there, significant reduction, and would a future date play into the bill?
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Benson, great comments, and I'm receptive to both. If insolvency is the word that kind of throws people off, if there's a better word or if there's a way to flesh out what we mean or what the certain conditions are, I'm glad to do that. And date specific, I think, would probably be a good idea. I guess my intention, and it's probably not really clear in the bill, is that in the next budget cycle, the budget books would actually have these high-level plans laid out in them for us. So a date specific would probably be clearer in that regard.
Representative Murray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the only thing here that is irresponsible is if we don't do any planning. And to say that this is going to put a big burden on the state of Minnesota, I just can't believe that. I have 10 employees, and I'm mandated by the Securities and Exchange Commission and by FINRA to do contingency planning. And you know what my contingency planning is? It's for every possible risk that I have in business. So as we go through this and look at this, I have to identify risk. I have to estimate the impact of those risks. We have to look at strategies to handle those risks, a plan for continuing the monitoring of those risks, and then we have to recommend steps. I have 10 employees. I have to do this every day, every year, every month. It makes sense to have a contingency plan. If we lose a major client, if we have a disruption in service, if we have some law changes or code changes, we need to plan for those things. We need to have things in place, and we're mandated by the federal government to do that. I don't think trust is the problem here. I have the total faith and trust in the U.S. government. But I think we need to make plans for the possibility that payments in the future could be reduced. If interest rates start going up right now, and Representative Downey, do you know what we're paying on our national debt in interest costs right now? I was trying to come up with that number. And
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, I do not. Maybe somebody here actually could say what it is currently. I think every piece of debt that gets issued is going to vary somewhat based on the term and the size and that kind of thing. So I couldn't tell you what it is.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Murray.
My estimation is it's in the $300 million, $400 million range a year. The problem I worry about is we have a pie this big of federal money, and the only thing we can do is print more or grow our way out of this. And we are issuing a lot of short-term debt right now, and that short-term debt is being issued at under 2%. So we have a lot of debt the federal government is rolling over on a very regular basis at under 2% interest. If all of a sudden the federal government has to start paying more interest because inflation worries, those types of things, start kicking interest rates up, the cost of our interest, the cost of debt that we're going to have to add on could go from $200 or $300 million to $600 or $700 or $800 or $900 million overnight. Short-term interest rates, that's what killed the pigs. Portugal, Ireland, Spain, Greece, short-term debt that they couldn't refinance. That's what got them. And I think the problem is real. Does anybody remember Lehman Brothers? Financial firm, small one, I believe. In January of 2007, there was no problem with Lehman Brothers. Their debt, their bonds were rated A by the S&P. January of 2007. By September 15th of 2007, they were gone. They were in bankruptcy. A company that big, short-term debt problems got them in trouble, credit problems got them in trouble. I'm not worried about an insolvency here. I think maybe, as Representative Benson mentioned there, I think maybe we could work on that word, because I have trust in the government. I believe that, you know, that we'll figure this out and work on it. But my worry is that we could face payment reductions. And if we face those, we need to do this plan, and we need to make sure we have plans in place. And not doing it, I think, would just create a huge problem We can't grow our way out of this. You mentioned 500 million or 400 and some billion, I believe, of profits in the top 1,000 corporations. That doesn't address it. You could tax the whole thing, and we can't grow our way out of this. So I thank you for bringing this bill. I think this makes a lot of sense, and I think we really need to take a look at risk management and contingency planning. So thank you.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Downey. I too appreciate you bringing this bill forward, because I think it opens up the discussion, you know, to some good planning. I just want to express my disappointment with some of the statements issued by this committee and its members. I mean, so oftentimes we hear the statement that words have meaning, and I don't think that this committee, we're elected officials, we represent Minnesota, we have to do what's right and what is prudent for this state, and I don't think this is the place to make light of this bill. We called it irresponsible, we called it fantasy, we called it boogeyman and henny penny. I think we have a responsibility to do some planning. Now, I just take this all back. I'm just a small business guy with like a dozen employees. I worry about payroll and paying my mortgage, and I worry about how am I going to pay for tuition next semester for my children. And if you grab 100 people in Eden Prairie or Minnetonka, where I'm representative, and you ask them, hey, do you think that the federal government might ever cut back some of its funding to the state of Minnesota? Overwhelmingly, they're going to be concerned about this. Any business, and I'm actually, I wrote down the word organization, but since I was reprimanded that government is government, any business or government needs to do a risk assessment. I just have a small company, and I worry about what happens if I lose my biggest customer. What if I lose my biggest source of revenue? That's just common sense. That's just like business 101. That's just organizational, you know, understanding. What do you do when you lose your revenue? So we have to do that, and we can't just put our head in the sand and pretend that you know, this is never a possibility. I refuse to even consider this. I'm not so worried about federal insolvency, but I am concerned that we should have some plans and some understanding. Where are our federal funds coming from? How does that fit into the? I would guess most of the representatives don't understand. I know I don't have a full comprehensive picture of where the federal funds coming in, even into the state government finance piece, and what federal funds are tying into our budgets. And I think that those departments, they know where their money is coming from, and they need to make those plans. So thank you for bringing this bill forward and having a great discussion.
Representative Banyan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think the last two Representatives Murray and Stensrud covered one of my thoughts on this. Although Representative Hayden, any reference to Book of Eli, thumbs up. I love that movie. it's a great movie. But although I will come back to that in a second. But first of all, just a couple clarifications. First of all, looked up. I've got the CBO report in front of me here, and the amount of money we pay on the federal debt right now is about $200 billion with a B dollars. I heard something with an M instead. I want to make sure we're clear on that. Rises under the current projections to $750 billion by 2020. The two wars over the last 10 years, total over 10 years, $1.17 trillion, compared to a $1.6 trillion deficit just in this fiscal year. Okay, so the size of that CBO's projection is that if you were to reduce the troop levels overseas to 45,000 troops, you would only save about $129 billion or about 7 or 8% of the size of the current deficit. So let's not delude ourselves into thinking that somehow the wars are responsible for a majority of what the debt is right now. Let me also point out that having worked elsewhere in countries which suffered fiscal strokes, a place like Ukraine, which suffered 10,000% inflation in 1993, I was there about 18 months later for a year working on that. You'll never make a movie about it. It will never, okay? In fact, have you ever seen a movie made about the inflation in Weimar Germany? You know, in German you'll find them, but they're not Hollywood. They're not Hollywood productions. But you will, but you'll find some documentaries perhaps, and I think there might be one small movie. The types of things we're talking about when we talk about federal insolvency aren't the kinds of things that you make movies about. I've been to Indonesia, which basically had a crater put into the middle of it by a real estate bubble that collapsed there in 1998. You won't ever make a movie about that, but the size of the impact, not just on their federal budgets, but the budgets on the 14,000 islands of Indonesia, were profound. And you could have used some planning there. In Ukraine, you could have used some planning in terms of intergovernmental transfers that the rayons, the districts around Ukraine would have expected. They had a significant impact there as well. But they don't make the things that go into movies, okay? No, the federal government won't actually come out and say, we're insolvent and refuse to pay on any dollar. It doesn't have to. It can go to a printing press and solve that. But that, too, is repudiation. And I'll come back to where I spoke before. Inflation is the threat here. It's a very real threat. And in the process of doing this type of contingency analysis that you're contemplating, I really do hope we can get to that issue and how it impacts the state budget.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I concur with my colleagues. I want to make this short. I'm wondering if we can go a step further. Have you given any thought about breaking out the federal impact when we do our fiscal notes?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger. I did not, and I'm trying to think. I don't know, for example, over in the human services and education areas, whether or not those fiscal notes include the federal interactions or not. That might be a question for staff. I did not, Representative Leidiger.
Thank you. That was that's all. I think we could take it a step further. Thank you.
Representative Slawick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really have a process question, but I will just comment on Representative Leidiger's comment. Is I know in for child care, for CCAP, there's a significant federal funds, and our departments are deciding how they're spent, and other states, the legislatures decide that. They give a lot more direction. So this legislature could probably get more involved in the federal discussion by legislating some of those funds. But my question, Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, is about process. Aren't we headed towards a second policy deadline on Friday, and did your bill pass the first deadline through the other body?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Slavik, I think the opportunity for action on this particular bill is less as a standalone vehicle moving through to the floor and more as a possible amendment into the zero-based budgeting bill. But I'd maybe defer to the chair in terms of process and how this could or could not fit into our committee's deadlines.
Mr. Chair, isn't it that they all, traditionally, if they didn't make the first policy deadline in the House or the Senate, then the bill is dead? But now we have a bill, I think, with no Senate companion.
Mr. Chair, we did meet the policy deadline. I mean, this bill was heard in government operations and reform last week.
Okay.
I think the bigger issue is the fiscal issue and the fiscal note not being here and how we would move this forward from here.
Mr. Chair, so the process, would it then you get the fiscal note and go to Ways and Means still this week? I mean, doesn't it have to meet that? I'm just trying to clarify that it's on the correct.
Representative Slawick, my understanding is that we need to clear this bill this week, and it obviously would have to be moved on to Ways and Means, correct, Representative Downey?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, if it were to travel as a standalone bill.
Okay. Thank you. I mean, I just think we also have to be mindful of the process as we head into less than 3 weeks of session here. Part of me thinks when we're debating bills like this about planning for federal budget deficits, we've got a $5 billion deficit right here, and we really should be making the plans to fix that and get out of session on time. So I hope we'll just keep an eye on your bill, Representative Downey. You want to see what the process is as it unfolds here.
Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up, you know, we've heard comments from other members about inflation and the concern about inflation and reduced payments and so forth, but it's just important to remember what the bill actually says is insolvency, and it talks about risks of the federal government's inability to meet its financial obligations, leading indicators of the federal government's inability to meet its obligations. This is not about dealing with the debt in the long run and what might happen to the state of Minnesota. This is much more of a doomsday scenario that this bill contemplates. And if we want to talk about contingency planning on a more realistic basis and find out what the administration actually does, that would be a worthwhile exercise. And then Representative Stensrud's point about and Representative Murray's points would be well taken. But that's not what this bill is about at all. This bill is about assuming some kind of end of days scenario with the federal government, and then asking the state to worry about its deficit in that case. And Representative Banyan, to compare the United States to the Ukraine, Weimar Germany, Indonesia, and others talked about Portugal and Greece, is really just silly.
Members, Representative Downey. We will come back to this bill as soon as we have a fiscal note. And Representative Downey, if you have any intent of tweaking any of the language, it would be good to get that settled soon.
Yep.
So that members could be notified of that. Members, I would hope that none of us are under the impression that we're not going to have to make some adjustments in the future about what the federal government may provide to us. I think it's very clear that the federal government is not going to be able to continue to fund various things in our state, other states, to the extent that they have for years. That just simply is not going to be feasible. And so to me, it's very prudent for us to be about the business of contingency planning for what happens if and when we should have reductions in payments from the federal government. That seems to me is not irresponsible. That's responsible government. With that, members, we have two bills tomorrow, the Banyan bill and the McFarland bill, and so our meeting today is adjourned.